We're not out of this. We'll probably have several more days, if not another week, before this breakup on the Yukon is complete.
More Yukon River villages brace for flooding. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 18th of May. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, firefighters begin weeks of mop-up work on the Homer wildfire.
I can't believe we didn't lose more houses.
Yeah.
I swear.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river. And by the new AT&T, your world delivered.
The head of a U.S. Senate oversight panel is looking into small business contracts awarded to Alaska Native corporations. Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri, sent letters to the heads of 20 corporations last week asking for information about their business practices. The companies include the major regional corporations, Chugach, Doyon, and Arctic Slope, and some village corporations like Afognak and Tyonek. Alaska Native corporations are allowed to get contracts through the Small Business Administration's 8A program, which is intended to give a leg up to disadvantaged companies. But while other 8A firms have limits on the size of a contract, Native corporations get extra advantages, like the ability to win sole source contracts of any value. Supporters say the 8A contracts have saved the government a great deal of money, but critics say the Native corporations are getting unfair advantages to monopolize contracts. The CEO of the American Small Business Coalition, Guy Timberlake, says he's in favor of Alaska Native corporations getting small business benefits, but he says the concern is that they get so many advantages over other groups.
There seems to be a little imbalance in the level of benefit afforded to Alaska Native companies. And it's not that they don't deserve support, and it's that they don't deserve any support whatsoever. That's not the point. But there are other groups, whether it's socioeconomic or otherwise, that should be considered at least in parity with the Alaska Native companies.
In the last fiscal year, Alaska Native corporations reaped a record $5 billion in federal contracts. The president of NANA Regional Corporation, which represents Northwest Alaska, says the company has received McCaskill's letter and will do its best to turn over the requested information. But President Helvi Sandvik says it's a lot to pull together, and they may ask for some additional time. Sandvik says she believes McCaskill's inquiry will help the senator better understand 8A contracts.
I didn't view it as a call for examination of the contracts, but rather I viewed it as a desire by the subcommittee to better understand Alaska Native corporations and their participation in the 8A program. And so that's the perspective I have as I take a look at the letter and the information that they have requested.
Sandvik says NANA pursues business opportunities to help its 12,000 shareholders and plays by the rules set out by the Small Business Administration.
As representatives of economically disadvantaged people, we benefit from special contracting rules, and we, as well as many other economically disadvantaged people, have been working to take advantage of that program, but operating within the rules as the program was laid out for us.
Sandvik says about 55% of NANA's net income last year was from government contracts. That's up from 45% the year before. Senator McCaskill has scheduled a hearing to look into the situation on July 16th in the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on Contracting Oversight. She has asked the companies to turn over information by the end of next week about their business relationships, stocks, executive compensation, total revenue from federal contracts and subcontracts, and cash dividends paid out to shareholders. Alaska Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich have sent McCaskill a letter saying her call for a hearing is of, quote, great concern to them. Flood waters are still roiling along the Yukon River. Many villages are not out of danger by any means, and River Watch flyover teams are working with villages all down the lower Yukon. John Madden is director of Alaska's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says they get their best information from a River Watch team of state and federal experts.
There's a team now flying out of St. Mary's looking at all of the lower Yukon all the way up to about Holy Cross. There are now flood warnings issued for several of the communities along that stretch of river, and that team is now landing at each one of the communities and giving them personalized briefings so they can then decide how best to deal with it.
Is there anything that can compare to this year?
Because of the amount of water and the thickness of the ice and the snowpack, it's a very unpredictable year for it. It's very, very unusual that there have been places with solid ice with open water above and below it, and it breaks and moves ice down as a whole flow of it, miles and miles long, to bypass where it should jam and go on and jam someplace else.
What is the state providing for villages like downriver from Eagle?
Well, then several communities along the upper Yukon have received direct assistance for food and water and medical care, along with assistance from the Red Cross and other voluntary organizations that are active in disasters. The state has dispatched emergency management people to help the communities organize, public health nurses, environmental conservation for spill and other concerns.
And how about funding? Is there adequate funding for this particular emergency on the state level? And how long do you think it'll be before or if the state asks for federal assistance?
The governor decided within hours after this flood started in the upper Yukon to declare a state disaster existed. And that provided access into the state Disaster Relief Fund, and we have all the funds necessary to meet these emergency response needs. As we're looking at the extent and the amount of damage, we'll be assessing this week whether we will request financial assistance from the federal government. The federal participation will be on sharing the cost of this emergency phase of the disaster and sharing the cost for the recovery efforts.
Is this about over, or do we have another couple of weeks of this, or what?
We do know that there are flood warnings for several communities on the lower Yukon that were put in place today, and we have the teams flying throughout all of those communities, leading the water, giving out the warnings. We're not out of this. We'll probably have several more days, if not another week, before this breakup on the Yukon is complete and all the way out to the ocean.
John Madden is director of Alaska's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has agreed to make an initial determination within 4 months on whether the Pacific walrus merits protections under the Endangered Species Act. A federal judge approved a settlement today between the agency and the Center for Biological Diversity, which sued in December to force a decision. The group is petitioning the agency to list walrus because of lost sea ice habitat due to global warming. The group used the same justification to successfully push for protection of polar bears. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage residents take on a unique art project.
I think we'd make a cool t-shirt. He could say, I survived an economic collapse and a volcano, tougher in Alaska.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF Fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Mop-up work has begun on the East End Road wildfire outside Homer. Over the weekend, an evacuation order was lifted, and crews were able to get the fire 100% contained. However, it'll be a number of days and even weeks before firefighters leave the area. KBBI's Casey Kelly has the story.
If you're going to take a tour of a wildfire with anyone in Alaska, Pete Buist is your man. Buist is from Fairbanks and has been fighting fires in Alaska and the lower 48 for 41 years. He's a big guy, easily 6'5", with a wispy graying beard and a hearty laugh. But more importantly, Buist knows firefighting. Before getting into the public information end of things, he was involved in nearly every aspect of fighting fires, from operations to investigation. And did I mention that he's been doing it for more than 40 years?
But it was a lot easier to pass the physical test for going on a fire line when I was 20 than when I was 60.
It's raining when we first arrive at the McNeil Canyon Fire Station. Buist says maybe this isn't such great weather for a tour, but at least it's helping to put out the fire. Then he tells us how things are going to go.
We'll just drive out into the fire. We'll talk on the radio to the operations people and let them know that we're out there.
With that, we pile into three SUVs and head out East End Road, past the Alaska State Troopers roadblock, and toward where the fire started. Three houses are known to have burned in the fire, but Buist tells us we won't be able to see any of them. He says he purposely doesn't know where they are, so he won't have to take us there. Part of that is because he wants to protect the owners from having to see their burnt home on the evening news. He does begin to tell us about some of the challenges firefighters are facing. The weather for one, and road conditions for another.
The engines that are best suited for structure protection are, you know, heavy vehicles that are not suited well to, you know, turning around in small areas and that sort of thing.
About a mile or two into the fire area, we come across our first crew, a four-man engine from Buist's home turf, Fairbanks. They're working to identify hot spots close to the road and put them out. These are the heavier fuels, like big logs and stumps, that will stay hot for a while and have the potential to flare up again when warm, sunny, breezy weather comes back. The crew has found one about 50 yards from the pavement. One crew member cuts up the bigger chunks with a chainsaw, while another soaks the whole area with a hose. Two more guys use axes and shovels to mix everything up. Christian Blankenship is the engine boss for this crew.
It's basically an old burn pile I pushed up by a dozer at one point, and I just burned in real deep. So we're going to go ahead and bucket up all the trees that are intermixed in that hot ash and get that out of there so we can spray water and mix it up with our hand tools.
About 250 firefighters are working this wildfire. That includes crews from the State Department of Forestry, the Federal Bureau of Land Management, and many local fire departments from around the state. They range in size from 20-person hotshot crews to the next group that we come upon, which is a two-man engine from Anchor Point. Anchor Point volunteer firefighter Nathaniel Brown is looking for hot spots close to a group of houses. He's digging a deep hole to make sure that he's found all of the heat.
Pretty much as deep as the duff and vegetation goes that's been piled up for years.
I asked Pete Buist how many of these hot spots are within the 1,000-acre perimeter of the fire.
Well, thousands. There are thousands of places like this within the outer perimeter of the fire. Now, the ones in the interior are not an issue unless they're by someone's house.
Go ahead.
Back in the SUV, we drive further into the fire area until we come to a small subdivision. We pass a house that the fire burned all the way around, but incredibly, it's still standing. Buist says he doesn't want to stop here because the only reason that house survived is dumb luck. He'd rather show us a house that didn't burn because the homeowner created what firefighters call defensible space to keep the flames from reaching their structure. He finds one and points it out.
We got that little gravel trail where the fuels are just a little sparser that didn't burn, and you've got fire on either side, and you got the other piece of the driveway that kept that ground fire from moving up right to the front of the house. That is very cool.
On the way out, we pass a pile of rubble that's roped off with pink caution tape. It looks like the remnants of a mobile home or a trailer that burned in the fire. Buse says he doesn't know anything about it, and even though he told us we wouldn't see any burned structures, he stops and lets us take pictures. He's not going to pretend like we didn't see it, he says. Then he says what's on pretty much all of our minds.
I can't believe we didn't lose more houses.
Yeah.
I swear.
Although the three houses and a small number of outbuildings burned, more than 150 houses in the fire area are still standing. And that, Buse says, is considered a success. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Crowley Marine is launching a couple of brand new tugboats specially designed to ply the Great Lands coasts and rivers. KNOM's Paul Korshan has more.
Craig Tornga is Crowley's vice president for petroleum distribution in Alaska and has been with the company for over three decades.
We call them the Ikut class tugs. It's a new pick for shallow, and we chose that word to represent the shallow waters in western Alaska where these tugs are going to operate. The vessels themselves are called the Nautchik, which stands for hair seal. And then the second tug that will come online, it's about a month behind, is called the Sea Sock, which stands for beluga whale.
Tornga was among those at the Seward dock this past weekend for the Nachek's christening. The two new tugs are modeled after a vessel Crowley built in 2005.
What we found with the boat is, we have some real challenges, and specifically some of the village up there in Norton Sound, if you've tried to get into White Mountain, Elam, even Unicleet on some of the tides, you really need some special equipment that's got the horsepower and can be shallow draft to get in.
The Nachik will work mostly in northwest Alaska, says Tornga. The Seasock, which is almost finished, will be based further south. The 76-foot tugs were built by Diversified Marine out of Portland, Oregon. They feature 1,362 horsepower engines capable of 12 knots, and they have drafts as shallow as 3.5 feet. The tug's propellers are also specially configured for low water.
It's not a new design. We have tugs like this that we built in the 70s that actually have tunnels up in the aft end of the hull. We've had a lot of vibration problems in the earlier version, but we've made some changes and have had some real good success with this design. So the stern hull configuration, it puts all three propellers up in a tunnel in the hull. The blades aren't the deep part of the hull that's catching anything on the bottom.
Other features include aluminum, where possible, instead of heavier steel, lighter and cleaner electric deck equipment rather than hydraulics, and spill-resistant fuel tanks. Nome Mayor Denise Michaels was given the honor of christening the Nachek on Saturday. She told the city council she managed to break the champagne right on cue.
And I got it on the first swing, so that's good luck. The tug's specifically made for Northwest Alaska and our villages in Nome. It's a really awesome state-of-the-art tug.
Tornga says Michaels left nothing to chance.
If you would have seen Denise's swing, there was no threat that bottle wasn't going to break. There are a lot of superstitions when you're out to sea, and one of them is if you don't break the bottle the first time, the vessel's cursed. If you swing three times and it doesn't break in three times, it's basically doomed. Denise had talked to the Coast Guard, and they had briefed her and put that fear in her mind. So when it came time to christen the vessel, she had a swing that there was no doubt that bottle was going to break.
Crowley's new tugboats are even capable of limited ocean towing. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
A Sitka man accused of killing four people last year admitted to committing the acts during court proceedings last week. Jason Abbott will likely be sentenced to at least 40 years in prison. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Jason Abbott was 18 when he stabbed five people on March 25, 2008. Four, including his grandparents and an aunt, died. Another aunt was seriously injured. A little more than a year later, he pleaded guilty, but mentally ill, to three charges covering the crimes. Attorney Scott Sterling represented Abbott in Sitka Superior Court.
Mr. Abbott has a lengthy history dating back to childhood of serious mental illness, including disease or defect for which he has received both psychological and psychiatric treatment and counseling. At the time of the incident that constitutes his offense conduct, he was unmedicated and was in a psychotic episode brought about by severe schizophrenia.
By entering the pleas, Abbott admitted to stabbing and killing 69-year-old John Abbott, 68-year-old Alice Abbott, their 40-year-old daughter Elizabeth Abbott, and her 37-year-old partner Charles Tate. John and Alice Abbott were Jason Abbott's grandparents. Elizabeth was his aunt. Another aunt, Mary Ricketts, was badly injured but survived and attended the court proceedings. Guilty but mentally ill is not a common plea. Defense attorney Sterling said it covered the situation.
A defendant is guilty but mentally ill if, when the defendant engaged in the criminal conduct, the defendant lacked, as a result of a mental disease or defect, the substantial capacity either to appreciate the wrongfulness of that conduct or to conform that conduct to the requirements of law. A defendant found guilty but mentally ill is not relieved of criminal responsibility for criminal conduct.
He said the plea also required that the defendant be treated for his illness during his prison sentence. Superior Court Judge David George conditionally accepted Abbott's pleas to two counts of first-degree murder and one count of first-degree assault. He said he wanted more information on Abbott's mental state before fully accepting the pleas. Defense attorney Sterling said Abbott had been treated with medication since his arrest. That led the judge to ask whether the defendant was able to understand the court proceedings.
Mr. Abbott, I understand you're on your medications. Have you been taking your medications in accordance with your prescriptions?
Yes, sir.
So you haven't been taking in excess of your prescriptions?
No.
Do you feel as though the medications which you take prevent you from going forward today with a rational, well-reasoned decision?
No, they don't.
An agreement between prosecutors and the defense calls for a sentence of 40 years in prison on the murder charges. Additional time could be added for the assault conviction. Prison time would be followed by 10 years of probation. The judge said he was not bound by that agreement and could extend the sentence. He also said Abbott could face civil commitment when he finishes his prison time. Abbott, now 19, sat quietly in Sitka Superior Court during the change of plea hearing. He answered questions from the judge with short sentences or just a few words. He showed little emotion as the charges and their consequences were explained to him. Family members attended the proceedings and discussed providing victim statements afterward. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Sitka.
Alaska Democrats have chosen Deborah Williams, an official in the administration of former President Bill Clinton, as their new executive director. Williams says the new job will be to help accomplish the party's platform goals and to build it back to the majority status it held through much of the state's history. Based on the election of Mark Begich to the U.S. Senate and a 50% representation in the state Senate, Williams says Alaskans appreciate what Democrats can offer.
And I am so excited to be part of helping to put forward and advance the outstanding Democratic platform.
Williams was Special Assistant for Alaska Issues to the Secretary of the Interior. She is currently the president of Alaska Conservation Solutions, a group specializing in drawing attention to the effects of global warming. What happens when artists' skills collide with 4 tons of construction equipment? Anchorage art fans had a chance to view the results this weekend when a local gallery showed the woodblock prints of Steamroller 2009. KSKA's Len Anderson has the story.
There's the edge of the image.
Yeah.
In the parking lot of the Mountain View Trailer Supply Art Gallery, the Steamroller print crew busily prepared one woodcut after another for pressing. Over the freshly inked wood blocks, they precisely placed and taped down a white drapery cloth of cotton and polyester followed by a large paper sheet and then another cover. Stepping back, they signaled the woodblock was ready for printing. Guided by a duct tape line and hand signals, a 4-ton steamroller driven by either Gary Collitz or Amy Bloomer chugged over the print, paused, and backed up to press it a second time. Then, along with the artist, the crew peeled away the covering and examined the upside-down back side of the new print. The woodblocks were made from 4x5-foot plywood sheets. The cutting of something this large is a long, tedious, and often painful process. Just 2 days earlier, artist Angela Ramirez was finishing her steamroller entry. The plywood completely covered the kitchen table in her Spinard home.
Most woodblock prints are not this large. I think the biggest linoleum block print I've ever seen was like maybe 2x3. This is not the normal size. I don't even think the Japanese printed this big.
Ramirez's woodblock is coated in black with the portions to be cut out in white. The scene is dramatic and a bit ominous.
This is an image of dollar signs with wings, and they are in the forefront of an image of Mount Redoubt volcano, and I think the title of this is Blown Away. I think it would make a cool t-shirt. You know, you could print this on the front, and on the back you could say, I survived an economic collapse and a volcano, tougher in Alaska.
Tougher is a quality that the woodblock artists themselves need for a project this large. Ramirez held up her wrists.
They're fried. My wrists are fried. I'm glad this is almost over. I don't know if they could take much more.
The works are as varied as they are striking. Giant dragonflies swarm over one picture. Three rabbits in a medieval playing card configuration are in another. There are geometric designs and mystical figures. Not only do the prints capture the eye, but so do the rows of woodblocks also drying and destined to become part of this Friday evening showing. Gretchen Segan, one of the coordinators, says steamroller printings are always pretty popular, even if a bit daunting for the artists.
It's a very public process. You can see there's lots of different activities taking place here. We've got inkers, we've got people building stretcher boards, we've got people laying the paper on the panels, and so everybody can get involved.
This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Paul Korshin in Nome, Ed Schoenfeld in Sitka, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.